This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In Podcast Network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hello and welcome to episode 9 of the Asian Cinema Film Club, the podcast which aims to provide an introduction to all that is great and wonderful about Asian cinema. I'm your host as always, Edward Jones from the Depths DVD Hell, and joining me of course is my co-host, Mr. Stephen Palmer.
Hello there everybody, thank you for having me again.
Tonight's show we are going to be looking at the hidden gem of sorts with The Man from Nowhere, a Korean action thriller which brings to mind the likes of John Wick as a quiet pawn shop keeper with a violent past decides he's going to take on the local drug ring to get back a young child who is probably his only friend. But before we obviously get into our selection for this evening, I mean, we obviously have to ask, what have you been watching? And I mean, Tim, what's been holding your interest since the last episode?
Well, over at Eastern Kicks, it's that time of year where we have to get our top 10 of the year sorted. And there's a complicated, because there's so many writers, there's a complicated mechanism where we have to watch so many films and off the list of highly rated movies. And I'm very behind, partly because of work, partly because I'm doing this now, and partly because I've got a bit lazy with the writing. So I've had a bit of a catch up and I've caught two other super films. Pang Ho Chung's Love Off the Cuff, which is the third in his Love Off the trilogy with Sean Yu and Miriam Young, which is a fantastic return to form in a sort of a light, frothy Hong Kong comedy, dramedy sort of thing. And then I picked up a copy of The Villainess, which is something I have been waiting to see for a long, long time. And as tonight might show, I'm not a huge action film guy, but I was blown away. It's the best Korean film I've seen this year by miles. It's got visual flair. It's got that wonderful mashup of that you usually get in Korean cinema of half an action movie and half a soppy romance. It's got blood, guts, and three astonishing set pieces. And I can see why Arrow picked it up to check it out on DVD and Blu-ray this year.
Yeah, I mean, The Villainess is certainly really high up on my sort of wish list at the moment. You know, just dropping some hints in case anyone hasn't got me a gift yet for Christmas. But no, I mean, since I saw one of the set pieces, which was essentially a sword fight on motorcycles, I've been kind of really into wanting to get this one, see this film. So it's certainly really high up there, I think, along with Park Chan-wook's The Handmaiden. It's just one of those two films that I really, really want to see. And whether it's from the success of The Raid that we're seeing this sort of film, or whether it's just that the Korean market's now just decided to really sort of make an impact on the action genre. It's really hard to say why this film has suddenly sort of come seemingly out of nowhere, because I can't really think of anything similar to come out of Korea that sort of shot or looked like this film does. So I'm kind of very glad that it lives up to the hype and obviously what we've seen from the trailer.
Trailer, I think it actually released sort of a 6-minute segment, didn't they, or something like that. So yeah, the motorcycle, well, that's the second set piece. The opening set piece, I really don't want to spoil it, but the opening set piece is if you remember the scene from Old Boy where he goes down the corridor having the corridor fight, Double yeah. Dragon style. Well, let's turn it into a first person shooter. and it's done like that, but that only half tells the story. The camera flies around it. Just watch it. it's amazing. And what's most exciting about it is actually suddenly Korea has a female action star. There've been a few, and there's actually the booklet that comes with the DVD, with the Blu-ray, actually talks about this, that Korea have been desperate to get a female action star. And there's been some attempts before, but they've usually involved female actresses, great female actresses, who action and physicality isn't their number one skill. And how they chose Kim Ok-bin to be this person, but she's astonishing. So I'm really excited to see if she continues on down this vein. It's a brilliant action movie, and it's brilliantly Korean. So yeah, that might be my number one pick of the year.
Spoiler alert then for anyone looking.
That doesn't mean it'd be number one on Eastern Kicks list. Okay. A long shot.
Well, anyone who's regularly listens to this podcast will know a couple of episodes back that I was voicing my general upsetness at the fact that Love Film had closed its doors, no longer doing physical media rentals. And obviously this presented some like a bit of an issue, because obviously if you just have the streaming services, you are limited by what they choose to show you. And at the same time, trying to watch things in that sort of window of time which they're available to watch. So it was kind of with some sort of great joy that I did actually manage to find a new disc rental service, which is called Cinema Paradiso. Now, their whole setup works pretty much exactly the same as Love Film, and you obviously set up your list, and they send you out the disc based on your priority. Obviously, this is nothing new. I mean, it's a rather unfortunate name for a rental company, especially because if you try to search up anything, you're just going to find loads of references to the very popular movie of the same name. But so far, it's been absolutely fantastic. I love the fact as well that it's geared towards foreign and international cinema, which is especially for people like myself and Stephen, is absolutely fantastic when you're trying to find like those Hong Kong, Korean, Japanese titles that just never seem to turn up on Netflix or Amazon Prime or any of the other sort of streaming services. So it's been great in the fact that I might finally get to watch My Wife as a Gangster, for example, or Peace Hotel or Dragon Tiger Gates. These are the titles that you have the urge to watch, but you either face with paying for a premium disc because you can't find a cheap used copy, or sort of playing the waiting game for them to eventually show up on the streaming services, or perhaps they show up on like late night TV, maybe like Film Forward show. It's part of like the foreign block, for example. But it's great to have another physical disc rental service, and I'm glad that there's a company still out there offering this option, because there are a lot of titles, especially if you are into sort of those more obscure sort of titles, and it can be an absolute pain to get hold of them. So to actually have still a disc rental service really is a bit something very welcome in my life still. So I'm very happy to be using them at the moment, and obviously being able to finally cross off some of those titles that have been sort of sitting on the wish list for far too long.
Yeah, so I think I may have been a little dismissive of you last time when you were talking about it. And I kind of wanted to apologize, because actually Love Film was one of my major entry points into Asian cinema before I found out you could order things from abroad. So I remember getting some of my very first Takashi Miike films from Love Film. And so I think it does, there is a part to play, because there's nothing, streaming is fine, but it still relies on the internet. And not all of us have got smart TVs and things like that. And sometimes you don't want to watch it on your PC or your laptop or whatever, and you want to watch something in a more standalone format. So I think there's a place for it. And I've just had a quick look, and I've just looked under Hong Kong movies alone. And it's got quite an impressive world cinema selection, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there are obviously some titles which are noticeably missing. Certainly some of the Arrow titles in particular. I was unable to get hold of copies of Battles for Out Honor and Humanity, which is a bit of a shame. They are missing a couple of the volumes of the Female Prisoner Scorpion series, but the fact is that if you're looking to pick up these sets, you're looking at paying a premium, unless you're like Steven and an absolute jammy git who manages to get them cheap somehow.
eBay, my friend, eBay.
Well, I'm just not even going to go onto that, shout on that mountain. But it's, I know a lot of people don't like the format that Love Film use, where you've got to obviously have the ranking, and because they can never get the titles at the top of the list. But if you keep a tight list, and this is why I'm finding sort of the key thing going into it, is that I'm not just putting in like those sort of impulse sort of titles on that. I'm trying to keep it a really sort of tight list of essentials and just keep my top 20 in particular as the ascent, as like the films I really want to see the most. And so far, you know, touch wood, I've been able to just get this through that have been films I want to see and not something that I put down at like number 138 on the list. So, yeah, so far it's working out well. And hopefully, as we said before, it's going to help me cross off some of those titles. So without having to just buy them and then have to find somewhere to store them in the house. And, you know, it just avoids that whole side of things because, you know, there's only so many discs you can store in your house.
Yeah, welcome to my life. But yeah. Yeah. Oh, well, yeah. Oh, God. No, I shouldn't be watching this live. I'll look at them my own time.
It's fine.
But I just went to Korean movies and I thought, wow. But yeah.
On the old anime scene, at the moment, my interest is currently being held by Kill la Kill, which is currently showing over on Viceland, and you can watch it on Netflix as well. This is a fantastically funny series, and if you can get past the fan service heavy element to the show, which it does actually play up for comedic effect, and it is intentional. This is just such a great action series. It's so lighthearted and fun, especially after battling through Tokyo Ghoul and how dark that got in its second series. It's kind of nice to watch something a little lighter, a little more refreshing, as you have this girl seeking revenge against the head of this school. And all the enemies she faces are the heads of the different hobby groups. So you've got like the tennis club, you've got the wrestling club, the sumo club. And all their attack styles are based around the sport they represent. And this show gets increasingly bonkers as it goes on. Certainly, one of the main bosses in it, she heads up the marching band. So all her attacks are based around using musical sound waves and just blasting pomp and circumstance at her. It's just such a fun and enjoyable series. And it reminds me of why I like anime so much, really. Just because the fact you can have something so unbelievably random, yet within the context of these worlds they create and the rules that they play by, you're perfectly happy to go along and accept it, no matter how bonkers it gets. But I mean, I would ask you, Stephen, if you've seen this, but you're not really a big anime guy, are you? So
I'm not someone who's going to go and hunt out anime on my own, but sometimes I'm tempted to spend an afternoon in the company of such things. So yeah. you never know.
Well, it's, as I say, it's on Netflix now. So if you can like not like tear yourself away from binging whatever Marvel's hawking this week, which I think, I mean, we got the new Punisher series coming out, which I've heard good things about in non-Asian cinema news.
Yeah. No. Yeah, if only it was only Marvel stuff that Netflix are giving me. But yeah, absolutely. If I give anything a shot, these things normally aren't too much of an investment of time just to try it out.
Cool. I mean, obviously, if you have got any recommendations of yourself or you want to share what's been holding your interest, please do let us know. We do have the Facebook group, which is open. Just look up Asian Cinema Film Club and you will find us on there. We are on at AC Film Club. We are also on Instagram as well. And if that doesn't work for us, you can always drop us an email, which is acfilmclub@yahoo.com. And, you know, let us know your thoughts. We always love to hear from you. Now, because we're looking at The Man from Nowhere, which is something of a hidden gem, because Netflix have sort of thrown it into the middle of their back catalogue and not really drawn too much attention to it. You may see it as it sort of comes past on your just your general selections, but it's not been one of those films they've gone out of their way to really highlight as being there. But it is really, for myself, something of a little hidden gem. So it got us thinking as to what other hidden gems are obviously hiding out there on the various streaming services. Now, when we were conducting this list, some of us had their list worked out, only for Amazon to decide they were going to take them all off the list. So, if you come to this and find they are no longer available to stream and they're being charged for it, we do apologize, but you know, blame Amazon or Netflix or whoever's responsible for those. So, I mean, Stephen, what did you manage to find when you were obviously looking for these sort of secret finds?
Okay, well, I'll start off on Netflix. I found three movies. Well, one I knew was on Netflix and I wanted to pump, but two which I was a bit surprised. So the films I'd seen before, but I am very surprised that they're on Netflix UK. So the first one's a Korean film called The Silenced, and which is different to the Korean film called Silenced. So The Silenced is a period mystery thriller sort of film to start with, set in 1930s Japanese occupied Korea, where a young schoolgirl who's got something like TB or something like that is sent to an all girls boarding school, both to sort of a bit hide away from the Japanese imperialism, but also to improve her health. They start getting better, some mysterious stuff starts happening, and it's a beautiful looking film, but then goes batshit crazy in the final act. And if you can predict what's going to happen, you're a better man than me. But it's a really good little film, actually. And I was just surprised to see it there. It's got some great performances from both the young actresses and some of the more established cast. And like I say, it feels more like a Japanese film in the sense that it goes pretty mental at the end. It's genre stuff. It's not super deep, but it looks great, and it's very entertaining. Shall I go through all of mine?
Yeah, you want to go for your list.
Okay. The other one on Netflix is 2012 Hong Kong Chinese romantic comedy called Lacuna, starring who's it starring? Sean Yu, who's a fairly popular, I don't know if he's mainland Chinese or Hong Kong, but he's in a lot of Hong Kong films. Actually, he's the star of Love of the Cuff, which is what I was talking about earlier, and Chinese actress Zhang Jing Chu. And it's a sort of about it happened last night kind of thing. These two strangers wake up in a bed together in a shop in the middle of it one morning, and they don't know what happened the night before, and they basically sort of walk back through their night trying to work out what happened and repair their broken relationships and so on and so forth. Hugely entertaining, and the sort of film I was expecting nobody outside of Hong Kong would ever see. So to find that there, it's not a very old film, but it's an incredibly unlikely film to be on there. And I recommended it highly when I reviewed it a couple of years ago. So definitely go for that. A little bit different. So this is something Netflix is one of their own originals. Is a documentary called Joshua, Teenager versus Superpower, and it's a documentary about Joshua Wong, who is the young student who I think he's now been in prison, but he has been at the forefront of the sort of the Yellow Umbrella Revolution in the last few years in Hong Kong, protesting against mainland China's sort of slow, insidious grip on Hong Kong's independence. It's all a bit complicated, but it's a very entertaining, it's only about an hour long, but it's a very entertaining, very informative documentary, which I suggest you spend a little bit of time with if you've got a chance. And then on Amazon, again, I found a couple of films I was really surprised about. Black Coal, Thin Ice, from a couple of years ago. It's a mainland Chinese film. Stars Gui Lan Mei, who's one of my favourite actresses, and Lao Fan. It's like a serial killer film noir art house film. It's a bit, with a very interesting and dark visual style. Deep story, happens over a couple of time periods. You know, it's a quite a demanding watch, but it's a really solid film. And then it's about time I started bringing up Stephen Chow movies, and to find on Amazon, as well as your Kung Fu Hustles, there's also probably my favorite Stephen Chow film, Love on Delivery, which I can't believe is there, which is a bit of a strange 1994 film he did, completely wacky, nonsensical, classic pre-Shaolin Soccer Stephen Chow, really. So a good place to start to see if you're even going to like it. So they're my five. How about you?
You did a lot better than me. As I said, because Amazon decided to screw in mine. Obviously, starting with the live-action adaptation of the anime Samurai X with Rurouni Kenshin. There are three parts to this series, and all three were available for a period on Amazon Prime. But prior to them as recording the show, they decided to take them off this week. So thank you, Amazon, for that. Really fun pop samurai action movies. You can probably find a lot of the action scenes just by looking on YouTube, which, if you're a fan of Izumi, you really get a kick out of these movies because it's essentially more of the same. And certainly if you enjoy them, then definitely check out the series Samurai X, which is currently available on Netflix as well, although the third season is kind of a bit sticky. The first two are still as solid as when they were back when they released. Staying on the pop samurai trend, if you scoot over to High Dive, you can now start watching Samurai Punisher, a series which is absolutely infuriating to find any sort of information on because Netflix have decided to release their Punisher series, and that's basically all Google wants to tell you about. But the series itself, it follows this chap called Mondo Nakumi, whose wife and co-workers think he's this incompetent. But at night, he sheds his civil servant disguise and teams up with Tetsu and Joe to as his trio who basically fight crime and corruption. It's a really fun series. As I said, it's currently streaming on High Dive if you have a premium subscription, with new episodes released on Fridays. So, yeah, the first two are currently available on there now, and it's definitely one worth checking out. Over on Shudder, the horror streaming service, you can find a film which we actually talked about on our previous episode when we did the horror draft, and that is the movie Death Bell, which is a Saw-like thriller as these high-grade students find themselves pitted against a killer who is out to test their intelligence by putting them into traps which will obviously kill various members of the class unless the rest of the class can solve the challenges being set for them. Death Bell, as we mentioned on the previous show, is a really underappreciated gem of a horror film and one that is definitely worth discovering. So it's kind of surprising that Shudder is the place to find it, but it's definitely one worth checking out. And Shudder as a whole is a site which has got some really great horror films on there, not just in terms of Asian horror, but also in terms of a lot of Italian horror on there, and retro horror as well, which is just makes it a great service to check out on a trial. Plus, if you want, you can always just rewatch Battle Royale for like the 100th time on there, which is also on there as well. Rounding out my picks, we have go back to Amazon Prime, who currently have the vast majority of the Shaw Brothers back catalogue. Unfortunately, though, the covers they've decided to go with for a lot of these films makes them look like they're going to be very cheap and throwaway Hong Kong movies. But you have a lot of really great stuff on there. You've got like 36 Chambers of Shaolin, 8 Diagram Fighter, My Young Auntie, and you even got some more of the more obscure ones, which are all just worth checking out and just discovering the wide range of films which the Shaw Brothers released. It wasn't just obviously just the Hong Kong Chop Socky movies, but you also had a lot of interesting dramas, a lot of some horror films in there as well. So it's a catalogue well worth discovering, and it's great to have Amazon Prime obviously offering you the option to watch that on there, as they seem to really take a drive towards pretty shameless additions to their catalogue and some of the stuff that's been showing up there recently. So, yeah, if you like Shaw Brothers movie, it's currently the best place to go and a way to avoid paying trader prices for discs, certainly. Yeah, that's my pick. Certainly, Stephen, you did better, it seems, on finding these hidden gems.
Yeah, well, maybe it's because my eyes went to things I'd seen. But, yeah, it's really hard. So certainly world cinema isn't very well served by either the main two. I haven't really delved into, I mean, I have done some reviews for Eastern Kicks because of things from Shudder, so I was aware of that, so I didn't think about looking there. But there's bits and bobs, but then you find something like I said, like Love and Delivery, which you can't even buy on DVD in the UK. I mean, when I watched it, it was of some obscure little pirate thing I found somewhere, and to find it. So I'm actually going to go and rewatch it through Amazon, because it's a real favourite of mine, and one that I haven't been able to physically get hold of. But it's slim pickings, and you have to keep looking.
It's a little frustrating that we're still waiting on a live action streaming service for Asian cinema. We have plenty of services, such as we mentioned earlier. We've got like High Dive, we've got Crunchyroll, which service the anime side of things. And while High Dive does actually include some of the live action films in their catalog, it's still feels very underrepresented. And it sort of brings it back to the importance of having those physical disc rental service, just because it enables you to see other stuff that other than just what's popular with sort of Western audiences at the moment. So I still hold out hope that someone somewhere is going to give us a decent one, be it perhaps Arrow will add more to their sort of streaming library, because at the moment it's a little limited. And it's kind of infuriating the fact that you have to pay on top of your Amazon Prime to add the selection on. But I'm hoping that someone somewhere will hear our cries and set up a decent live action catalogue for Asian cinema.
That's not an illegal stream from China.
Yes. Right, well, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we're going to be looking at our feature film this evening, which is The Man from Nowhere.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we are going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com, or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
And we're back. You are, of course, still listening to the Asian Cinema Film Club. I'm Elwood.
I'm Stephen.
Obviously, tonight we are looking at The Man from Nowhere, which we're going to talk about in a minute. But in the meantime, please do let us know your thoughts on the show. If you want to follow us on Facebook, we are there as the Asian Cinema Film Club. We are on Twitter at AC Film Club, as well as Instagram as well. We love, obviously, anyone who wants to share their thoughts on films we should be watching or what you think about the show. We'd love to hear from it, and we've had some really nice feedback on the Instagram and whatnot. So we do love to obviously hear from you, and obviously hopefully craft a show that helps you obviously discover these aspects of Asian cinema you perhaps didn't discover, or just gives you new thoughts on films that you knew already. Certainly coming up next month, we are going to be doing our Kaiju Christmas, and we want to hear from you, especially to hear your recommendations and to vote on what you feel we should be looking for the inaugural Kaiju Christmas. So make sure you heads up on those sources and let us know your thoughts. But back to tonight's show. We are obviously talking about The Man from Nowhere. Now, this was released in 2010 and is directed by Lee Jong-woo. As I said, it's a South Korean action thriller, very much in the vein of John Wick, as it features this pawn shop owner called Chai Tae Silk, who is basically living his quiet little life. He is happy just keeping to himself, although he has like a friend in this little girl called Sumi, who basically lives next door with her mother, who is also a drug addict and sort of hooked up with the local drug and organ theft ring. When she and her mother get kidnapped, it falls down to Chai Tae Silk to basically get her back. Unfortunately for this ring, they also don't realize the fact that he has also got a past, which gives him some very useful skills, as we will obviously go into as we get into this film. But I mean, this was a rewatch for yourself, Stephen. It was a first time watch myself, because this is a film which I'd heard constantly mentioned whenever someone was talking about John Wick, in particular John Wick 2, they would always say about The Man from Nowhere as being this amazing comparison piece. And the fact it was on Netflix and no one ever seemed to talk about it. So that's kind of the reason I picked it, to finally see what all the fuss was about. But, I mean, as a rewatch, how did this one hold up for you, Stephen? Because I know that you weren't the biggest fan of it the first time you watched it. So did it play any better the second time you watched it?
So I'll just start by saying I'm absolutely delighted we're 9 shows in and we're finally watching a South Korean film. I can't believe it's taken us this long. And when you suggested Man from Nowhere, I thought, yeah, I quite fancy that, because I think I must have watched this back in something like 2011. So probably not long after it had come out. And I remember not being particularly blown away by it. And I just remember one scene in particular. There's one shot that I remembered, and the rest of it, I just felt it was kind of meh. And I had actually bought it on iTunes with an idea of rewatching it years ago. I never got around to it, so this was a perfect opportunity. I have to say, I think my impressions of it have gone up, but I still think it's okay. And I can't believe it's got like 100% on Rotten Tomatoes. I must be the only person in the world that's only mildly impressed by it.
It's, I mean, it's a film which I think I went into it thinking it was going to be a little more sort of action-packed than it was. I think it was a very much a different film that I ended up with than the one that I thought I was going to get. Certainly, now you mention it, I mean, I can't believe it's taken us this long to actually look at a South Korean film, especially because South Korea in recent years has been where a lot of the most interesting aspects of Asian cinema have come from, when we've had people such as like Park Chan-wook coming through the ranks. It's, and films such as like Brotherhood, a film which actually bested Saving Private Ryan for my money. We had these amazing films sort of like coming through, and I have no idea why it's actually taken us this long to get to look at a South Korean film. So I do apologize to any fans of South Korean cinema that it has taken so long, but you know, we finally made it. This film though, I liked the way it actually flows, because this is a film where it could easily have just been like action scene, action scene, action scene, but instead, it's actually teased out to really sort of the final quarter when we actually get any sort of real sort of big action scenes. Up until then, we have these really kind of humorous scenes where a hero of sorts is basically like cornered by the bad guys, and then it will either cut away at the last second as he goes to react, or you have like some outside shots, such as there's a scene where towards the start where he's basically being threatened by these hired goons, this drug ring inside his pawn shop, and you have this big like sumo sort of style guy who's like 6 foot and weighs about 300 pounds, and he's like stomping up to him, and then it suddenly cuts the outside and you see like this guy being thrown through a window essentially. And I love that, the fact that it builds up so you think, oh, I'm gonna see something, and then it takes it away. And it's reminded me a lot of the recent Godzilla remake, where we have the first confrontation between Godzilla and the Muto monster, and you see him going head on, and then it just cuts away to the child watching TV. But in this case, it's an effect which actually works really well. I mean, how did you find the actual pacing of this film then, Stephen?
So I think this is what I struggled with, is that, as you say, what we get is these sort of cock teases, like where we see the action just about to start, and then we see the aftermath. Whilst I got that the first time, it's not until the final act we really see what a badass this guy is. You know, he's got to wait till he shaved his hair and had his topless scene in the mirror and stuff like that. I mean, it's a lot of good looking people, and I'll talk about Won Bin in a minute, because he's an interesting an important person in Korean cinema, although his CV is small. But you know, when that the final I don't know, third of the film, actually, is very exciting. But up to then, I think it is held together by the charm of the lead actor and the fantastic performance by the child actress. And apart from that, it's nice looking people in nice suits sort of talking and running around a bit.
I know what you mean. I mean, here we obviously have a child actor who's not irritating. Something of a rarity. Although it does, I don't know about yourself, but it does seem to be getting better in recent years that they're able to have child actors who aren't just irritating.
Well, actually, in Korean cinema, there's this awful habit of there are some fantastic, especially female, young, under 10 female actresses that just seem to be churned out, the girl here, Kim Se-ron, is one of them. It seems to be a very unique, you know, they're not just sort of like cute looking, chubby faced little things, you know, that's powerful acting. And there's one scene in particular where she basically says, you know, she's having there's been a schism between her and her friend. And she basically sort of sits there and stands there and says, oh, you know, my mother's crap. She tells me to go and kill myself, and we should probably all kill ourselves. And what you've done's really hurt me, and I want to hate you. But if I hate you, then I won't have any friends left in the world, however bad you've been to me. But it's really powerfully done. And this is from a girl who was like 10 years old at the time. So her performance is astonishing. And actually, she's gone on to be, a very interesting actress in her own right. So she's in the kind of fun sort of thriller movie called Manhole. But more importantly, she was in she starred opposite Bae Doon-ah in A Girl at My Door, which won a lot of awards a couple of years ago. So she's quite choosy about her roles, but she is she's probably in the sort of that next range of superstars that's going to happen. So I think she's fantastic.
Yeah, I love the interaction that her character and Bin Won's lead have. Certainly in the opening sort of scenes where he's providing her some sort of stable sort of home life, even though he really doesn't want any sort of interaction with anyone. I mean, he's largely mute throughout the film, really, and I think until towards the end. And he's there and they're having dinner, and her mother comes looking for him, and the fact he's like trying to cover for the fact that she's there, and he's like trying to talk to her through the door, and at the same time he's using his foot to try and hide this extra meal that he has on the table, just to try and continue this illusion that he's there by himself. So it's kind of charming, and it brought back memories of like Leon or The Professional, as it's known in the States. So
I definitely think Leon is the template for this one. That's what this. I think that's probably why I didn't like it. I just thought this is Leon in Korean, but that's being awfully unfair to it, and probably unfair to Leon as well.
Because, I mean, obviously with those sort of scenes, it did bring to mind obviously Leon, but the fact that it's such a fleeting sort of interaction that these two characters have, it's not the whole sort of basis of the film. The fact that it's just basically him using his unique set of skills to track it down.
Yeah, a bit like Taken.
Exactly. And that's the other sort of comparison. So, I mean, you can either say it's like Taken, or you can say it's like John Wick, the fact that you have these drug dealers who basically think he's just, you know, this quiet pawn shop owner, but he's actually an absolute badass. And it's, they quickly learn what happens when you screw with the wrong guy, as he basically starts dismantling the whole operation. And while it starts off with them essentially playing games, setting them up to take out a rival drug ring, interestingly enough, at a golf range, which seems to be a continuously theme within Asian cinema, the fact that whenever you're looking where the local triads or Yakuza are going to be hanging out, it's always at a golf driving range for some reason.
It is a common trope, isn't it? I'd noticed that. It's lots of bad shit goes down at the driving range for sure.
And the question is, so, and I kind of liked the fact that this quest that he goes on, he's just like constantly battling his way through these different stages. Like he's at the golf driving range, he's at the nightclub, he's at all these sort of very sort of traditional sort of locations, this sort of film. And the fact that all the while you think, oh, now we're going to get the big action scene, now we're going to get the big action scene, but he really sort of holds off in giving it till we have, like, we're essentially in the bathhouse before we finally get that big payoff and get the style of action that is very reminiscent of The Raid in many ways, but it's perhaps not as flamboyant. We do get some very tasty sort of knife fighting, but here it's a lot more focused on sort of gunplay. Just how the gunplay in particular is shot is just absolutely, it's so cool to see. The fact that he's very rarely looking the direction he's shooting, he's just firing with this like almost psychic ability to hit anyone with shot marksman style accuracy. It was absolutely astounding. But I mean, how did you find the action scenes in this film? I mean, obviously, at the moment, we have no sort of shortage of decent action in Asian cinema. I mean, with films such as like The Raid and sort of Donnie Yen's current mission to revitalize and reinvent the kung fu genre, it would seem.
Yeah, so this is a completely different sort of thing. This is a more visceral, I'm going to bunny ears realistic. You know, this is normal people punching each other, not necessarily with a super martial arts skills, although there is a bit of that. The knife fight, as you say, with the Thai actor who's playing a Vietnamese guy, because that happens in Asian cinema as well, is good. I do remember the one thing, as I was saying it, but the one thing I had remembered from watching the film before was this, an amazing shot where our lead character sort of jumps through a window and the camera follows him through the window and down, I don't know, a story or two onto the ground. I remember being blown away by that the first time. This time when I watched it, it's been and gone in a second, and it didn't seem to show up as amazingly for me, because the world's moved on. This film's 7 years old, action cinema and cinematography, and again, I'll point to something like The Villainess, which takes that and turns that into a 7 minute sequence. It felt a bit dated, actually.
Yeah, but that being said, I mean, the film still manages some really great sort of moments of action. Obviously, we've got the bathhouse sequence. We've got the Mad Max inspired sequence where he takes one of these two brothers who are heading up this drug ring, and essentially straps a lamp of a kerosene lamp to one end of a rope and puts a bag of drugs in the others, which are slowly leaking out onto the floor. So this lamp's going to like incinerate him. And this Mad Max style situation I had, these sort of like crates here, I thought that was so cool to see that particular death scene in particular.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Certainly in the second half of the film, last third of the film, you know, it's action packed. There's some really creative stuff going on. So, I'm really torn, because there's that going on. There's a fantastic dynamic between lead and the young girl, even though you're quite right. The other thing I'd remember, I had forgotten, that they barely spend any time of the film together, do they? I mean, it's a few early scenes really, and after that they're very apart until the end. But yeah, I don't know, it just didn't hang together for me.
Okay, now just I'm gonna say spoiler alert here. When we have the ending of this film, it seemed very reminiscent of like the Bruce Lee movies, and the fact that no deed shall go unpunished. In the fact that he goes on this epic quest, you know, he's killing drug dealers left, right, and centre, and at the end he's arrested by the police, which is far from the sort of traditional Western action hero ending that we expect, where, you know, the good guy John McClane or whoever blows away a few dozen bad guys and, you know, he goes away scot-free at the end, completely free of any sort of judgment. Whereas here, as in was the case of many of the Bruce Lee movies, he ends up getting arrested by the police and carted off.
I don't think he ever really got cleared for being accused of killing the the mother, the drug addict mother of it. And that's so I don't know. I kind of wanted there was talk of a sequel or a prequel and things like that. And it just feels wonderfully Korean to me that they do like a downer ending, don't they? There are plenty with happy endings, of course, but quite often it's and maybe it's Asian cinema, not just Korean cinema, but I do quite often feel that karma catches up with people. And whilst you may do one good thing, the 500 bad things you've had to do to get there don't balance out. So maybe there's something in that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously with the Man from Nowhere, I mean, it was one of the best-selling films in Korea in 2010. I mean, have you seen anything else by director Lee Jong-bum? Because I know he obviously did Tears of the Dead, which is another film which constantly seems to get mentioned. But
that's pretty much all he's done. He's made three feature-length films in this. So I was a bit. I was thinking, is IMDb wrong? But no, he's done very little, which is surprising because everything he's done has been a success. Of course, the other thing we have to talk about here is our lead actor, Won Bin. So to you and me, he's just a ridiculously handsome Korean guy, right? Even as straight men, we can see that this guy is phenomenally handsome. Well, in Korea, I can't express what a big deal this guy is. He is viewed as being the perfect man in terms of his look, his visual, his body, his hair, everything like that. What if David Beckham could act? Yeah, something like that.
I think seeing the recent King Arthur, we know that David Beckham can't act.
Yeah, which is why I put the what if.
Yeah.
Not only that, he's only been in six films. Yeah, but the films he has been in include Guns and Talks, which was one of the first sort of Korean films to make it out of as part of the Korean wave. He was in Brotherhood, which you mentioned earlier. He's in The Fantastic Mother. He then went off and did his national service, came back and did this in 2010, and hasn't made a film since. He's married to I can't remember her name. Crikey.
Lee Na Young. Yeah.
Lee Na Young is thought of by Koreans to be the most beautiful woman and embody everything I've just said about Won Bin. That's what they think about her. This is the perfect couple. She hasn't made too many films that recently, but she has done some stuff in the past few years. The guy, all he does now is makes adverts, but he is one of the biggest stars in Korea. And a lot of the things that are in this film that maybe disappointed us are absolute fan service to his adoring crowds. And so lots of people who are into like K-drama and stuff like that will be aware of Won Bin. And, you know, to see him, like I said before, all go topless in front of a mirror and cut his hair off. This is fan service to a different audience than the fan service we might be used to with, I don't know, animated schoolgirl panty shot sort of thing. Yeah. So he's a huge, huge deal who's made very few films, but they've nearly all been brilliant and certainly hugely successful. And I do believe he's actually just about to make another one after 7 years. So we'll probably be seeing his face again after a 7-year absence.
Yeah, it's I mean, this is an actor I'm very little time. I mean, this is my first experience with him, but he's very enjoyable as a leading man, which is normally when you've got a pretty boy, especially over here in like Western cinema, if you've got a pretty boy actor, it normally doesn't equate to being a good actor. It's just normally what would get buns in seats. So
no, I think he actually does put in a really good performance.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, like you say, in the first two thirds of the film he barely says a word. All the emotion shown, you know, through his floppy boy band hairstyle with his eyes and his mouth. He's got, and actually even that's something you don't often get with Asian actors is non-emotive acting. He's an extremely talented guy. I just wanted a bit more.
I know what you mean. But at the same time, there's so many subtle little sequences, such as when he's obviously in the police station and we have the sort of setup to another of those action scenes that we don't get to see. And it's really the first time he speaks for like the longest time in this film, and he does ask for his cuffs to be undone, and you have like that close-up of the cuff, just the slightly uncuffing. And then it just cuts to something else, and then obviously we see the surveillance footage and seeing him basically work his way Terminator style for a whole police station. That you realise just what a badass this is. I mean, the film itself is currently in the process, it's somewhere in development hell, of having an English language remake through Dimension Films, who announced that they were working on it way back in 2012. So I wouldn't really expect to see it anytime soon. You can, however, see a Indian remake called Rocky Handsome, which was directed by Nisha Kant Kamat, which was released back in 2016, and no doubt will be on Netflix soon, knowing their taste for Bollywood. So,
I mean, I think that does show its testament. Obviously, I have never been a huge fan of it. You sound like you think it's okay. But I just looked around. It's got universally fantastic reviews. And I think some of that's down to Won Bin and his fan base. I think a lot of it is, if you saw it in 2010, I think it would be more spectacular than it is maybe now. Not saying that it's aged badly. I just think that the world has moved on a little bit. I'll also pay some respect to, I mentioned him briefly, the Thai actor, Thanayong Wantrakul, who plays kind of his opposite number, doesn't he? They kind of make out he's a bit of a madman, this Vietnamese guy that matches him. And I did like that dynamic, the fact that they were mortal enemies, but there was this trust between them. And they both had a relationship with the girl, which impacted how things turned out. So I like that, because some of the other bad guys, the Korean guys, I felt were a bit overacty.
They were a little comical, aren't they?
One of the guys is actually a famous Korean comedian. So again, it depends a bit what you feel about Korean comedy, which can be a little bit unsubtle. So that might take some people out of the film, but yeah, I thought between Won Bin and Thanayong Wantrakul, there was something. There was a certain mano a mano frisson between them, which I thought worked quite well.
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit it right in the head there. I mean, certainly when we look at the performance of Kong Sang-ok, who plays more manic of the two brothers here, it does kind of take you out of it when we're obviously building this tone with Won Bin's character, who is very dark, and very sort of moody, not saying very, very much at all. And he's building this whole sort of persona, and you then have this almost maniacal drug dealer in Kim Sang-ok's character, Jong Seok. And it kind of made sense of the fact that they removed him as early as they did and really sort of focused on the other brother, Man Seok, played by Kim Hee-woon. Because when he obviously got into, when he's on the screen, he's a much more of a serious sort of gangster, more traditional sort of gangster character. And it made sense, especially when we have the setup for that big sort of final action scene where he's rolling the detached eyes, and we're led as the audience to believe that they belong to this little girl that he's been pursuing. And I mean, they really play out the fact that it's actually this girl, is her eyes. You know, she's been scrapped for parts like her mother was earlier in the film. It's a really, it kind of makes you wonder if perhaps they should have cut out the manic brother or like downplayed him at all.
Yeah, it's quite dark in places. So there's the bit where the mother, you know, that we find the mother's body, and sometimes Korean films can be a bit coy about showing nudity and things like that, but we see a full on naked corpse with Y incision in it. I was a bit shocked by that, actually. I remember when the first time I saw it, I thought, oh, that's very That's talking to a different audience than the locals. I was surprised when it was such a major hit because it's hitting a few taboos. But one question I will ask, though, about this crime family, and I think this is another thing which took me out of it. The film starts and they're drug dealers and it's some super duper strain of heroin or something, isn't it? I can't remember if it's heroin or cocaine. It doesn't really matter. And then suddenly they're into child slavery and there's a... There's a bit, isn't there, where the kids are going around Seoul moving drugs and messages around. And then it turns out they're into organ donations, ones that people aren't really
willing
to. And I think, hang on a minute, these two can't seem to drive a car. How are they running this multi-tethered, complicated crime family? I just wish they just stuck on one thing or the other. I will say in 2010 and the organ donation thing, you'll find that in a few films. It must have had some local resonance. There must have been some stories about these things going on that must have played well with the local audiences because it's like ripped from the headlines. But I found it very confusing what these people were actually doing.
Yeah, they never seem to sort of settle on one business enterprise. I mean, although when we obviously have the mother whose discarded body shows up in the trunk as a way to obviously frame one Bin's character, which seems to have been their big goal throughout this. And it's very confusing why they're making go for these different sort of tasks, really, what the actual goal of these two brothers is by sending them on this like gauntlet of tasks to antagonize a rival drug dealer and whatnot. And I mean, this also should be noted, this is the first film where I've seen someone be tortured with a hairdryer, which I have to give it credit for.
And that hurt me to watch that. That's quite a powerful... I'd never thought about it, but then I thought, yeah, it would burn you, wouldn't it?
It didn't dawn on me when I was watching. I was like, really? Someone's threatened by a hairdryer?
Nah, that thing heats up and it's quite powerful. So it's a very visceral film, isn't it? It's and it's not quite Old Boy, but you know, things seem to hurt. So even though Wong Bin, of course, is he's not invulnerable, is it? He gets hurt quite badly. So it's got a certain you feel the stakes, but he's not superhuman. He's incredibly talented, but you do think actually he could get shot or stabbed or something like that, which is quite a nice change.
Yeah, I mean, he is pretty brutalized by the end of this film. Certainly by the end of the bathhouse sequence in particular, he's not in pretty good shape. Although for some reason he's able to go around bleeding like a stuffed pig and still manage to function pretty well and have like emotional moments and with the girl when he reunites with her. Obviously, talking of them reuniting, I mean, why is there such an importance played on the bloody shopkeeper who he ultimately buys the school supplies from? There's like this whole relationship with the shopkeeper that's like really played up, but it doesn't really go anywhere or mean anything ultimately.
No, so it's kind of suggesting that this is the shopkeeper that sees Wong Bin as the girl's father.
Yeah.
And I think he knows he's not, but there must be more to it. It's almost as if there's like a deleted scene somewhere about the relationship between the shopkeeper and Wong Bin, as if the shopkeeper knows about Wong Bin's past and sort of saying, hey, look, here's your shot of redemption here. Here's your chance to be a father figure. But it's really weird because it doesn't really, as you say, never really comes to anything other than just underline something which was fairly bloody obvious anyway.
Exactly. It's, it's a bit of a random one there. But yeah, I mean, is there anything else in this one you wanted to talk about at all?
Not particularly. It's just strange that the main actor and the main... This film was a huge hit. And this film, you will find this film on DVD and HMV. You'll find this film on Amazon. You'll find this film on Netflix. You'll find this film in iTunes. this is an international hit. Yeah, a Pan Asian, a Korean hit, a Pan Asian hit, a worldwide available film. The director's made one other film in 7 years. The lead actor hasn't made a film. The child actress has made a few, but you know, to be fair, she's only like 17 now, so you know, give her a chance. It's just amazing. Something, can you imagine something this successful in the West wouldn't have spawned huge success for the creators, the equivalents? You know, this is this guy and this director, you know, he's inspired by things like Die Hard and the Bourne movies and things like that. You know, to think that he's only made one film since is really strange.
Yeah. It is. You would have thought, as I said, you would have thought that he would have made more. But then again, there are directors out there who sort of are making phenomenal films, but putting in like a 7-year gap between them. I don't know what it is about him that obviously makes him obviously want to like constantly put this layer. I mean, obviously he did No Tears for the Dead as sort of like his most recent film, but yeah, there's certainly nothing sort of showing in the immediate future there.
No, it's very, very strange. And I think that again, it's almost, I guess you think, well, I've done the biggest film of my career, two films in, where do I go from here?
Cool. Further viewing, I mean, what do you want to obviously pair this one with?
I am going to go for what I think is a superior film. It's another Korean film. Similar sort of idea. I'm just trying to find out what the director is. So it's called The Chaser. And it's actually by the same director as The Wailing, and I'm just killing some time while I try to remember how to say his name. So it's the first film by Na Hong Jin.
Okay.
It's a thriller. It's a guy who's a bit of a nasty piece of work, who gets involved in a similar sort of adventure through the back streets of, I think it's Seoul, but it's a really, it's a fantastic movie. It's an action, it's dirty, it's got the bad side of Korean crime, but I like it because the guy is our hero is not a good guy. our hero just isn't as bad as the rest of them. But it's very entertaining. And for me, it's a much more complete film than The Man from Nowhere.
Okay. Well, my original thought was obviously to go with something like The Killer. I've actually decided to go for something a little more sort of throwaway, and that is Ringo Lam's Ringo Lam's 1992 Hong Kong action film Full Contact. This is a Chow Yun-fat movie, and it sees him playing this gangster-style character who is basically trying to get his friend Jeff. He's trying to get his friend out of debt to this loan shark, and ends up teaming up with this villain, this guy played by Simon Yam called Judge. And they're looking to pull out this weapons heist, only for him to be double-crossed and sending Jeff, played by Chow Yun-fat, on this path of revenge in typical Ringo Lam style. This isn't probably the best Ringo Lam movie, but it is an enjoyable throwaway piece of Hong Kong action cinema, especially as you obviously have the likes of Simon Yam and Chow Yun-fat in the same film. It makes it quite enjoyable. In particular, seeing Chow Yun-fat's amazing training montage that he has, where he's at one point swimming upstream in the Bangkok River, which is pretty cool to watch. But there's some fun gunplay. There's the usual fire antics that we come to expect from Ringo Lam. But it's one definitely worth checking out if you want to throw away Hong Kong action film.
I've never seen it, so I'm going to I'll be checking that one out myself.
Yes, and I still need to watch The Chasers. We've covered on that many times when we talk about Cinema Shame, so.
Yeah, no. Yes, well, we must both do the right thing.
Next episode, is obviously December, which means it's Christmas, and we are going to be kicking off our inaugural Kaiju Christmas. And we are looking to you, our wonderful listeners, to decide which Kaiju movie we are going to watch. So if you want to obviously take part and send suggestions, please head over to the Facebook, the Twitter, the Instagram. Let us know which Kaiju movie you think we should be covering for our first Kaiju Christmas. It could be like Godzilla, we got Gamera, we got Rodan, Mothra. There is an absolute extensive catalogue of Kaiju monsters out there for you to choose from. Are you going to be kind and give us something really sort of art house and like highbrow, such as like the original Godzilla? Or perhaps you're going to give us like something really trashy, such as anything basically from the Gamera catalogue. The choice is really going to be up to you. We're going to create a short list and then put it up for a vote. But the winner will obviously be the December film of choice for us. So please do let us know. And we look forward to obviously seeing what you, the listeners, choose to subject us to, I guess. I don't know. It's always a bit of a concern when you put anything out to the audience, what way they're going to take it. So,
well, I'm sure our audience will put us through whatever we deserve.
That doesn't help. But obviously, this wraps up this episode of the Asian Cinema Film Club. Thank you, as always, for listening. Stephen, if people want to come and pester you on the internet, where is the best place to come and find you?
All right, so you can come to my blog at guelorramblings.wordpress.com. You can also find my writings, including interviews with directors and some features, as well as some reviews at easternkicks.com.
Cool. As always, you can find our full archive of episodes on our website, which is now all up and running. If you wish to find more of myself, it is from the depths of the hill .blogspot.co.uk. I am also on thatmomentin.com. We are a proud partner of this show, and where you can also find a full archive of episodes for this show as well. Currently on there, I'm still doing the Game Reviews of Game Warp, as well as the Movie Tourist, which most recently looked at the X-Files Fight the Future, where we took a look at the importance of the federal building in that film. But until next time, I'd like to thank everyone for listening. If you haven't done already, please do leave us some comments or rate the show on iTunes or Podomatic or thatmomentin.com, wherever you happen to be listening to the show. Let us know your thoughts and leave us a nice rating. It is all appreciated. I'd like to obviously say thank you to my co-host, Stephen.
It's a pleasure as always. Thank you for having me.
And until next time, good night.踊り続けていたい夜なのさ。